Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are discussing the U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza, which has killed more than 39,000 Palestinians, including 14,000 children. UNICEF says the death toll is likely much higher. More than 80% of Gaza's population has been displaced, and the majority of Gaza's buildings have been destroyed, according to the UN. We want to let you know that parts of today's discussion will be disturbing. Later in the show, we'll discuss Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, the day before he spoke to Congress. Over 200 Jewish activists wearing shirts saying "Stop arming Israel" were arrested on Capitol Hill. The Biden administration is still sending bombs and bullets to Israel. If Kamala Harris becomes president, will her policies be any different? We begin today's show by speaking with Dr. Feroz Sidwa, a trauma and critical care surgeon who practices in Northern California. He volunteered at the Gaza European Hospital in Khan Yunis in late March. Dr. Sidwa was not able to join us live. I interviewed him yesterday afternoon and began asking him to tell us how this trip came together.
I'm a member of the Society for Critical Care Medicine, and they sent out a call for volunteers through the Palestinian American Medical Association and the World Health Organization. So I saw that and I signed up. I've been involved in one way or another with the Arab-Israeli conflict since I was in college, basically. I've worked in the West Bank and I've wanted to work in Gaza for a long time, but I never really had a chance before residency. And then I hadn't had a chance since finishing fellowship in, 2018. So this was a good opportunity for me to be able to go and try to help there.
You and Dr. Perlmutter Wright, together in our combined 57 years of volunteering, we have worked on more than 40 surgical missions in developing countries on four continents. We are used to working in disaster and war zones, of being on intimate terms with death and carnage and despair. None of that prepared us for what we saw in Gaza this spring. So what really shocked you when you first arrived?
A few things, actually. One, when you exit the van, you know, for us, we went from the Rafah crossing straight to the hospital. And you get out of the van and immediately you realize the hospital itself is a displaced persons camp, not just the grounds of the hospital, but not anymore because the hospital was evacuated on, I think, July 2nd. But when we were there, the hospital grounds itself was a displaced persons camp. And even inside the hospital was a DP camp. So the hallways, you know, maybe they're 15 feet wide or something, but really they're 4 feet wide because there's a family's tent on both sides of the hallway where, you know, 6 to 12 people are living in a 6 by 6 foot space crowded on top of each other. That's where they're cooking if they have the ability. Nobody has any running water or anything, obviously. And so that kind of overwhelming population on the hospital grounds itself, you can imagine the impact that has. People have gone there because they think it's safer than wherever else they were, but it obviously makes it almost impossible for the hospital to function normally. And like I mentioned, I've worked in the Arab-Israeli conflict for a long time. I know a lot about it. I know what's been done to Gaza over the past, at least traced back to 2005 or even before that. You could go back all the way back to 1993. But, you know, Gaza has been slowly dismembered and dismantled over that period of time. And I've read about the social impact, the economic impact. I've read about it, but to see it in person is really quite different. To give anybody a pat on the back and feel their spine immediately, to see how every child looks 3 or 4 years younger than they ought to, and just because they're malnourished and they have been most of their lives. It's very different to see it in person. And then things that were really different in Gaza than in other disaster zones that I've worked in are quite a few, actually. One, the most shocking one was the violence, not necessarily just the fact that children got hurt, because you know, you could argue, well, yeah, we dropped a bomb on something and there was a kid nearby, so the kid got hurt. Okay, that's, you know, obviously that's not good. You'd rather injure fewer children, or I guess you'd rather fewer children be injured. But there's something very different when children are repeatedly and daily getting shot in the head and chest. That's a very, very different thing. And again, I knew about it. Like if you go back to the Operation Castellet in 2008 and 2009, I believe after that, Human Rights Watch wrote a report called White Flag Killings, where they talked about how Israeli forces had repeatedly shot down people who were walking around with white flags. I think it was after Operation Cast Lead, but I could be wrong. So I knew that Israeli soldiers did things like this. Yeah, I doubt it's ordered by the army, but it's certainly tolerated. But to see it in person and to see just day after day after day, every single day, one or more kids coming in with gunshot wounds to the head and chest, I guess just to know about it and to see it are very different things. It's very demoralizing, and it's hard to see, I guess you could say. I thankfully don't have major nightmares or anything like that. I'd say most of the other physicians who were on the trip and others that I know that have been on many other trips do have that kind of intrusive re-remembering and things like that. But that was one thing that really, really stood out. Another.
Can we stick with this for a minute?
Yeah.
So you are a trauma and critical care surgeon.
Yeah.
When you see children who are shot in the head, what does it take to try to save their lives? And in Gaza, do you have the supplies that you need to try to save their lives?
Not even remotely. In fact, most of them just went on to die slowly.
Ugh.
You know, like you said, I'm a trauma and critical care surgeon, which means my main job is to stop people from bleeding to death. You know, I work in Stockton, California, where we have quite a bit of violence, a very high-speed highway system where people get in bad crashes, things like that. So I get a lot of practice at my job, and I'm pretty good at it. But you can't do that job without supplies and without a trauma system behind you. Gaza European Hospital is actually bigger than the hospital I work at in California. I work at about 160-bed county hospital, whereas Gaza European Hospital is 220 beds. Of course, 1,500 people were admitted to it, but it's 220 beds, so it's bigger. You know, it should be. And furthermore, it actually does more advanced operations than we do here. It does cardiac surgery, which we don't do. But when there's no trauma system set up, it's very hard to save the life of, say, a small child who's been shot with military-grade hardware. And for a few reasons. You know, number one, oftentimes this isn't a civilian shooting where like two people got angry at each other, pulled out guns, fired, and a kid happened to get shot in the head. That kid gets to the hospital really fast. In these cases, there's a military raining down. Just, you can look it up for yourself. The amount of munitions that are being used in Gaza is just completely off the spectrum. There's nothing remotely like it anywhere for a place that size. It's just totally insane. So the fire doesn't allow for an ambulance to arrive quickly, and nor doesn't even allow for civilians to retrieve this child quickly. There's a video of a little boy. His name was Imad. He was shot in the arms of his 20-year-old cousin, who was actually a medical student. Her name was Hadil. This is, I think, in Gaza City. He's in the middle of an empty street. There's no way a sniper can't figure out that he's looking at a 3-year-old child. And despite that, anytime somebody goes to rescue him, they're shot at. So all they can do is videotape him. Mm. And eventually they reach a plank, like a wooden piece from a pallet, over to him. And when he grabs it, the Israelis shoot him again. That kind of thing. It is hard to see. That's pretty hard to fathom how somebody could do that.
And this is horrific to talk about, but we have to talk about this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, a few months ago, May 15th, I'm reading from an AP piece. The Biden administration is sending $1 billion more in weapons and ammo to Israel. And so you're talking about bullets and gunshot wounds and children who are slowly dying. Can you just tell us, I don't even know what this means when you say these children slowly die. Are we talking days, hours?
No, we're talking days. You know, it's pretty miserable. So, I mean, just to give you a typical example, say a 4-year-old boy comes in with a gunshot wound to the head. He comes in, he's not breathing, but his heart is still beating. So we put a breathing tube down, and maybe people don't realize it, but your brain can actually die without your heart stopping. So that typically is what happens because children are pretty robust. You know, their body won't give out for a little while. So the kid's brain will go on to die. Of course, that means he'll never wake up. He's gone. But if you put a breathing tube down and ventilate his lungs, you know, with a mechanical ventilator or with a bag, whatever you want to call it, the kid's heart will keep beating. Well, first of all, assuming the kid has family that shows up, the family is told is, look, he was shot, he's going to die, and there's nothing we can do about it. And so they just wait for 3, 4, 5, 6 days. Eventually, the kid gets pneumonia and dies of sepsis.
Hmm.
The one point of comfort, I suppose, is that the kid's been brain dead for a long time, so he can't feel anything. So he doesn't feel his death. He doesn't feel the pain and the fear and the anxiety. But of course, his surviving family sure does. And yeah, I mean, you watch these mothers at the bedside. And, you know, these, I'm not a religious person at all. But the Palestinians, you know, especially in Gaza, the faith is very, very strong. And they don't give up until the doctor comes in and says, I'm sorry, but he's dead now. It's just devastating. You know, these, especially the mothers, but even the fathers, they sit there and they hold out for a miracle, but it never comes. And they just can't, you know, it's torture for them. It really is.
And so this was constant when you were there in late March, because you write that these children would go on to slowly die from gunshot wounds, only to be replaced by new victims who'd also been shot in the head and who would also go on to slowly die. So this happened daily?
Yes, every single day with maybe one or two exceptions. And I just want to be very clear that I'm very aware and very sensitive to how crazed that sounds to an American audience, I'm guessing, that every single day, multiple times a day, across the Gaza Strip, Israeli soldiers are deliberately shooting children in the head and chest. I know that sounds completely nuts. I have no reason to make this stuff up. I just put the last signature on a letter that we're going to send. It'll be an open letter to the Biden administration, all sorts of other people, from American physicians who have worked in Gaza since October 7th. And one of the things we emphasize is that every single person on the list, and or every single person who signed the letter, I think we had about 50 signatures. Every single person said that they multiple times a day, almost every day, saw children shot in the head and chest. Mm. I think most people did work at European Hospital like I did, but there are people in almost every, I think we have a signatory from almost every hospital that was functional when they were there. And yeah, it's every single day. And again, I don't want anybody to think that I'm insensitive to, you know, there's a very, very, very ugly history of anti-Semitic claims that Jews are, you know, killing Christian babies to drink their blood, you know, the classic blood libel, all these sorts of things. I have absolutely no reason to participate in lunatic nonsense like that. I'm just a physician, and I can just tell you what I saw. And it really breaks my heart to say these things, because I don't take any joy in saying that I saw these things, but it just, it's what's going on.
In your Politico piece, you write that these children's families told you one of two stories. The children were playing inside when they were shot by Israeli forces, or they were playing in the street when they were shot by Israeli forces. Politico did reach out to the IDF. The IDF did not respond to specific questions for the story, but emailed a generic statement. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Feroz Sidwa, a trauma and critical care surgeon who practices in Northern California. He is a humanitarian surgeon that arrived in Gaza at the European Hospital in late March. Dr. Sidwa, I don't want to ask you the details of the little girl that you started the piece about, Jury, because this one really makes you just, I mean, it's all horrific, but the story you tell about Jury, it's almost like you have to shut down your computer for a few minutes because it's so intense. And then you can start reading again. And I did read social media comments from people who said every sentence in this story is so harrowing. This poor girl was only 9 years old, malnourished, barely conscious, in septic shock. I mean, again, you know, we don't have to talk about the details. I hope people read the story, but you can't really even comprehend what you're describing happened to Jury.
Yeah, she's a sweet little thing. Mm. The long and short of it was that, you know, she's a 9-year-old girl. She's never had enough to eat in her whole life. She has these very sharp features. I don't know who shaved her head, but it's just, she's very striking. Just physically, she's very striking. Now, I don't speak a word of Arabic, so I've never been able to understand anything she says to me. She shows up in the preoperative area, and the nurse asks us, it was me and Mark, we just happened to be there. We were actually waiting for other cases of ours to come by. And the nurse says, can you do this case? And we said, well, we've never met that person. Who is she? And the nurse just shrugged and said, it's a debridement, and walked away, because everything's a debridement there. So she was like, why are you asking? But yeah, when we looked at her, she was dying, and we didn't know why. If we touched her, she screamed in pain. So so we anesthetized her. And yeah, and like you said, you don't want to go into the details on air. Her injuries were horrendous. And it's important to realize that the bomb that blew her up was ours. Like, we sent it over there. knowing what it was going to be used for. It's not like it's some secret that a lot of kids have been hurt in this war. It's not some secret that a ceasefire could have been signed a long time ago. Nevertheless, we just kept sending the bombs, and we're still sending, like you just mentioned, we're still sending them. And I got to be honest, I'm kind of at a loss for words now. It's kind of hard to come up with words for people who would continue to send munitions to a country knowing full well that they're doing things like this. I mean, like, these things are a revelation maybe to readers of the American press, but they're certainly not a revelation. Like, the fact that children are being injured in this horrendous and totally indiscriminate way is not a revelation to our intelligence services or something like that. They know what's going on. I really don't have words for it anymore. I mean, when I was there during the World Central Kitchen massacre, that was April 1st. And I thought for sure, okay, that's the end. Now the administration is going to tell the Israelis, look, guys, you had your fun. You killed a bunch of people. Stop. It's getting too embarrassing. I've got to get reelected next year, meaning Biden. So pack it up. You got your pound of flesh. You're done. I was sure that would be the end of it, but it wasn't. And then after the Flower Massacre, almost 100 people, actually, I think it was more than 100 people, shot dead just while trying to get aid off of a food truck. It's like, okay, that's it. Now they're going to say it's done. Nope, still goes. Another Flower Massacre happens. Oh, this keeps going. Drop a bomb in the Mawasi area after saying it's the safe zone. Doesn't matter. I'm really at a loss for words now to describe the callousness of the administration in continuing to send these munitions to this country that is just completely and totally out of control. It's quite frustrating. I mean, I can go work in Gaza for another 10,000 years and I'm not going to be able to fix what was done. You know, I left the hospital one day. I think it might have been April 5th. I can't remember exactly, but I left the hospital. They strongly advised us not to leave the hospital, but I got the opportunity to drive through Rafah and Khan Yunis, and so I took it. And at the time, Rafah hadn't been devastated, so I don't know what it looks like right now. But when we went through Khan Yunis, we didn't even get out of the car, and you felt like it's this moonscape of a few people who look like ghosts, maybe whipping a donkey to get it to move a cart around with some wounded person on the back of it. There's one water bottle for every 50 people. I really just can't convey in words what it's like to be there. And I can't imagine the psychological injury, I guess would be the right way to say it, of this. There's a Harvard's leading expert, probably the world's leading expert on the Gaza Strip, is a woman at Harvard named Sarah Roy. She happens to be the daughter of Holocaust survivors, but she's an extremely intelligent and diligent researcher. She's lived in Gaza for a long time. She knows tons and tons of people there. But even in 2014, after Operation Protective Edge, she wrote that, I can't remember the exact words, but it was something like, I have never before seen the human and psychological devastation that I now see in Gaza. And that was 10 years or 11 years ago. And now with this, I honestly just don't know what's going to happen from this point on, because I cannot imagine how a Palestinian in Gaza who has lived through this, half of whom are children, you know, half of whom are literally under 18, and I think 40% of whom are under 15. I don't understand how they recover from something like this. I mean, it's not a small thing that's happened. An entire society has been leveled. It's been done on video, on social media. From, you know, it's social media captured by Palestinians going through it, social media captured by physicians who are visiting there, social media captured by Israeli soldiers themselves, even social media captured by the IDF itself, like officially, like when I forget which university it was in Gaza that they blew up, and they made sure to get beautiful drone footage of the explosion of this entire university. What do you say? I mean, like, how is anyone going to come back from this? Yeah, I know. I'm sorry to just keep repeating myself, but it's really, it doesn't leave you with a lot of hope for the future. It's pretty wild.
No, it's fine, really. Before we let you go, I do want to ask you, you talked about Palestinians, and in your piece, you wrote about the physicians and the nurses working in the hospital. You write that it was clear that they, like their patients, were physically and mentally unwell. I was really struck by this. You write, many staff had no sense of urgency and often no empathy, even for children. We were initially taken aback by this, but we quickly learned that our Palestinian healthcare colleagues were among the most traumatized people in the Strip. Like all Palestinians in Gaza, they had lost family members and their homes. Indeed, almost all of them now lived in and around the hospital with their surviving family. They've not been paid since October 7th. This is so devastating also. Can you tell us more about these physicians and nurses and what this experience was like meeting them?
Yeah, the observation about them lacking empathy or urgency is not meant to belittle them or play into any kind of stereotype about what Arabs are or aren't. But the reasoning for it, or what was causing it, was really, really just this incredible time, I guess, that I don't know what to say, that feels strange calling it an experience. But, you know, Gaza has been super isolated from the rest of the world for about the past 16 or 17 years, depending on when you want to start counting. And one of the only groups of people that have gone into Gaza, or actually probably the only group of people that's gone into Gaza regularly, are healthcare providers. And not me, it was my first time going there. But people like Mads Gilbert or Tanya Hodge Hassan, like these people have spent a lot of time in the Gaza Strip. And there are many others. And so they were kind of like a lifeline to the outside world. And the healthcare providers in Gaza have always been targets for Israel, because there's this kind of, where it came from, I have no idea, but this kind of absurd idea that Hamas is hiding under every hospital in Gaza, which just has no basis in reality. But with that bit of propaganda came this Israeli need to prove it, or to get someone on camera confessing that, yeah, Hamas was running around all over the place in Shifa Hospital or Indonesian Hospital or every other hospital. So in this war, if you want to call it that, the healthcare providers in Palestine are in Gaza are acutely aware that they are not just being incidentally hurt when the Israeli army comes around, they're targets of the Israeli army. So they have to live with that. They all say, don't go outside in scrubs because you'll be kidnapped. Like, and that's really like, this is a common fear in Gaza of physicians, of nurses, or really anybody. And so there's that fear. Like, I myself walking around every day am a target. So there's that psychological stress, I suppose you could say. On top of that, I think it was June 26th was the 500th known healthcare worker was killed in Gaza. You know, Gaza is a place of 2.2 million people, and it doesn't exactly have a developed healthcare system. It's not like there's, you know, every fifth person is a surgeon or something like that. That 500th person is 2.5% of Gaza's healthcare workers. So 2.5% of these people, one out of 40 Gazan healthcare workers has been killed by violence, not starvation, not nothing, just by violence in Gaza just in the past 10 months. Right at that point, 9 months. So there's that stress of thinking which one of my colleagues is going to die next if it isn't me. On top of that, just like everybody else in the entire strip, their homes have been destroyed. They've had family members killed. They've got no water, no food, no safety, no nothing. Their kids haven't gone to school in 9 or 10 months. They're, nothing. Nothing is going on that is normal or good in their life. On top of it, like you mentioned, they haven't been paid since October 7th, even though they all come to work all day long. And it's very admirable to see, honestly. But so with all of this combined, wondering tomorrow, am I going to end up dead or in an Israeli torture chamber, or one of my friends is going to be dead or in an Israeli torture chamber, or my hospital is just going to be obliterated in front of my eyes when I'm walking to it, or I'm going to get to the front of the hospital and some Israeli soldier is going to say, who are you? And I'm going to have to lie and say, oh, I'm here because my abdomen hurts, and then go away and pretend I'm not a doctor. Like, this is way too much for anyone to handle and to still have the mental bandwidth that empathy requires. There's just no way. There's no way. I wouldn't be able to do it. I'm sure you wouldn't be able to do it. There are a select few who can. I mean, and they do, and it's pretty amazing. But every human being has a limit to what they can tolerate, you know?
Right.
And the last bit about it, I guess, is that they're trying to provide healthcare in these circumstances where they have absolutely nothing. And sorry, getting back to the thing that I was saying originally, these internationals have largely been ripped away from them now. Israel took the Rafah crossing on May 7th. And since then, all medical teams have had to go to Jordan first, fly to Amman instead of flying to Cairo like they used to and go through the Sinai Peninsula to Rafah. They have to go to Amman, go over, I think it's called the Allenby Bridge, into the West Bank, through the West Bank to Israel, from Israel over to, I don't know if it's Kerem Shalom or Erez or one of the crossings with Gaza. And then they can go into Gaza. The requirement now is for 4 weeks from an international, which is extremely difficult to do. I thought I was going to die after Gaza in 2 weeks. Being in Gaza for 2 weeks is very physically taxing. Mm. And beyond that, the 4-week requirement makes it almost impossible for any subspecialist, especially subspecialist surgeon in the United States, to take off work. I might be able to do it in November, but that's because my partners support me and I happen to be a trauma surgeon. So our schedule is very fungible. So there's that. And then the third thing that the Israelis have started saying, they have repeatedly and explicitly, this is according to the World Health Organization, just the emails they send around, they have repeatedly and explicitly refused to let even American citizens who are of Palestinian origin volunteer as physicians in Gaza now.
Oh.
So, which is just outrageous. I mean, like, you know, if somebody asked, you know, what physicians were going to Ireland during the troubles in the 80s, I'm sure most of them were Irish Americans, not random Americans like me. You know, that's just perfectly natural. I mean, obviously you go help your own community. So now somebody has to hear, you know, some Palestinian American has to be told, oh yeah, your grandma was killed in Gaza, so you want to go there and help people, but you can't because your grandma's from Gaza. It's just outrageous. I mean, it's just this kind of thing, this level of utter disregard for the oldest and most cherished parts of international humanitarian law. International humanitarian law started with the idea that physicians and nurses who treat soldiers should be immune from attack. That's literally the origins of it, right? That's where the International Committee for the Red Cross comes and, you know, all sorts of stuff. Even if you don't care about Israel or Palestine, the United States fights a fair number of wars around the world. And it's not a good idea to advertise to the whole rest of the world that we will kill anybody we want to, whether or not they're protected under the Geneva Conventions. And that's what Israel is doing, and we're backing them 100%. When Russia bombs a children's hospital in Kyiv, we all protest, as we should. It's a barbarous and inhumane and lunatic thing to do. Mm. Israel destroys 20 out of 30 hospitals in Gaza. Like, the same guy that's over there saying, like Joe Biden gave this speech about the bombing of the children's hospital. He gave this speech, oh, who bombs a children's hospital? These people are barbarians. Well, you're bombing a children's hospital, man. You're just getting other people's pilots to do it for you. These are the things that the healthcare workers in Gaza, they see these things. They feel utterly and totally abandoned by the world. They feel like they are hunted in their scrubs by the, you know, most advanced army that exists in that part of the world, armed by the greatest superpower the world has ever known, with the quiet acquiescence of Europeans who just go around and do what the master tells them to do, meaning the American master, not the Israeli master. When an honest history of the period is written, people will be shocked by what the U.S. and Israel have done to the Palestinians. And not just since, I don't mean just since October 7th, I mean for a long, long, long time.
Well, I know you've been up for 24 hours, so I just want to thank you for sharing all of these really horrendous stories. Dr. Feroz Sidwa is a trauma and critical care surgeon who practices in Northern California. He's also a humanitarian surgeon who volunteered at the Gaza European Hospital in late March. You can read the Politico piece he wrote with Dr. Mark Perlmutter. It's called "We Volunteered at a Gaza Hospital. What We Saw Was Unspeakable." Find it at kalw.org. Click on News and then Your Call. Dr. Sidwa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
CBS Sunday Morning recently aired a 10-minute segment about the children of Gaza. Dr. Feroz Sidwa was featured in that segment, which you can find on today's web post. Go to kalw.org, click on News, then Your Call. Coming up after a break, we will be joined by Tara Kabash. In January, he publicly resigned from his job as a senior official at the U.S. Department of Education over President Biden's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the latest on the U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza. Joining us now is Tara Kabash. In January, he publicly resigned from his job as a senior official at the U.S. Department of Education over President Biden's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Tara Kabash is a Palestinian-American. In 1948, his grandparents, aunts, and uncles were forcibly displaced from their homes in Jaffa. Hi, Tarek. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we are going to talk about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to D.C. We'll talk about President Biden and why you resigned, and whether Vice President Kamala Harris's policies will be different if she becomes president. But first, Tarek, I know that you were listening to the interview we did with Dr. Feroz Sidwa. I mean, it was horrific to read the piece he wrote in Politico and horrific to hear what he had to say about his
volunteer trip in Gaza. I just wonder, what is your response to what you heard?
I mean, it's like you said, it's horrific. It's bone chilling. It's gut wrenching just to hear about that personal experience that Dr. Sidwa went through, watching Palestinians being massacred every single day, watching children come into hospitals with gunshot wounds in the head, effectively brain dead, but still having their hearts beat for days on end. I mean, it's just, it's unfathomable that we continue to allow that to happen. And it's unfathomable that our elected leaders who have, who've come to office representing the American people and representing the interests of Americans don't recognize that what is happening with our dollars, with our essential endorsement, is so inhumane that the rest of the world feels like this is what American values stand for, because it's not.
I wonder what your thoughts are about all of the praise for President Biden now that he has stepped down and endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris, given the full support that he has given Israel in weapons, bullets, for this ongoing assault on Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a difficult position for anyone to be in, to recognize that your legacy and your future is in an influential position is cut short. But I do think that his policies on Gaza, while maybe not the primary reason that he is resigning, although in my opinion it should be, or not resigning, but setting aside from running for re-election, you know, I think that if he had continued united support from his base, from younger voters, from voters of color, I think he may still be in a position where he could have weathered, you know, other concerns as to whether, you know, he could have stuck it out. But I think because of the ongoing resistance to change policy, to listen to the American people, there was already a significant fracture in the base. And I think that he didn't really have any sort of defense or protection from people who had been calling for a new, fresh face. And I think in a lot of ways, you know, there's a little bit of cautious optimism and hope that whoever does replace him, and it does seem like it is going to be Vice President Kamala Harris, you know, there is a little bit of a glimmer of hope that there's a possibility for a shift in policy now, or how Americans are going to be approaching this wider assault on Palestinian lives, this continued violence and genocide that we have been unconditionally supporting.
What do you expect from Vice President Kamala Harris if she does win in November? What changes do you expect?
You know, I think that it really depends on a number of different factors. But first and foremost, I'm hoping that it doesn't have to take until November and until she potentially wins the election for those changes to take root. The reality is that although she's not president and not making the calls on policy now, she is vice president. She is certainly influential in the process and in decision making, and she's the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party. I think those things combined make her very compelling as a conduit for new policy today. And I'm hoping that we don't have to wait 6 months until January for her to be inaugurated to start implementing some of those policy changes that humanize Palestinians, that end the war, that protect innocent lives. And so I think first and foremost, I think that's where we need to start. But I do think that she does have an opportunity to create very clear differences in what she believes needs to happen with respect to Gaza and to Palestinian peace and life. And I think humanizing Palestinians, calling for an immediate ceasefire, finding ways to ensure that our laws are actually being applied in a consistent manner to all countries. Right now, I think it's been pretty clear from experts who have left the State Department that, you know, there's numerous laws that we could be applying right now, except for we are choosing not to when it comes to state. And I think that has enabled the current violence and the continued facilitation of offensive weapons that really should not be flowing in the current circumstances.
I just wanted to mention a story from NBC back in March before Vice President Kamala Harris delivered remarks about the need for an immediate 6-week ceasefire as part of a deal to release hostages. Officials at the National Security Council toned down parts of her speech. The original draft of Kamala Harris's speech was harsher on Israel about the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip and the need for more aid there, were the remarks she ultimately delivered. This is according to a current official and also former officials. President Biden and Vice President Harris did not attend yesterday's speech that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave to members of Congress. They are planning to meet separately with Netanyahu today. I think what is going to be interesting, Tariq, is once Vice President Harris starts to do interviews with the media, I'm sure this is going to be one of the top questions, and that is your policy going to differ from President Biden? I mean, this can happen. This is probably going to happen in the next couple of days because people are going to want to know what did she talk about with Benjamin Netanyahu?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest with you, I bet we'll probably find out what they talked about sooner than when press can actually ask her, because Netanyahu has a pattern of leaking the contents of these meetings anyway, particularly if he's unhappy with them. So I think we should be more worried we don't hear anything about what was discussed in the meeting, because that might mean that he is very happy with the type of content response that he got from the vice president.
I want to talk more about Netanyahu's speech. He was invited by Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson. Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer signed on to the invitation after calling on Netanyahu to step down earlier this year. 136 Democrats boycotted or skipped Netanyahu's speech, according to Democratic strategist Waleed Shahid. They include Senators Bernie Sanders, Jeff Merkley, and Patty Murray. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs said, "Netanyahu has not brought the hostages home. He has not made Israel any safer. We need tangible actions to end this war and all the suffering, not performative gestures." Congresswoman Jacobs went on to say, "It's because of my Jewish upbringing and values that I cannot attend this address today." Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi opposed the initial invitation and also refused to attend the speech. A Palestinian and Israeli peace activist were at an event with progressive members of Congress who boycotted the speech. You were also there. Can you tell me what did people discuss at that meeting?
I mean, they discussed a hopeful future. They discussed what it would look like if, you know, we put aside our need and thirst for vengeance and revenge, and what it would look like if we actually met each other where we were, we recognize each other's humanity, and we recognize that peace is actually possible. And I think it was a really powerful message, and truly an honor to be with so many respected leaders who took a really brave stance to boycott the prime minister's speech, because I think at the end of the day, it is really important to be able to send that message to the American people that even though Speaker of the House, you know, invited him to speak and to address Congress, that, you know, there is no justification for the war crimes that have continuously been committed, and that we have to be able to move forward in a nonviolent way. And I think even Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech and what he was communicating was that, you know, he wasn't actually primarily interested in returning of all hostages. He wasn't interested in the immediate peace that I think so many Americans and people around the world have been calling for and demanding. You know, he was warmongering about the possibility of escalations with Lebanon and Iran, and I think the dangers that really poses both on the broader Middle East, but also for American interests, is really extreme. And I think we need to be extremely careful about what that looks like if we allow him to drag us into continued war in terms of American risk to American life and just the billions and billions of additional tax dollars that would not go to the incredible needs that we have here at home, but would rather go to continuing to fund a war that is not ours and that should not be ours.
I mentioned earlier that on Tuesday, over 200 Jewish activists, many with Jewish Voice for Peace, were wearing shirts saying stop arming Israel. Over 200 were arrested on Capitol Hill, and many more were at the event and were not arrested. During the speech to Congress, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called protesters agents of Iran. Yesterday, I also interviewed Josh Paul, who could not join us live, former State Department official in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, who resigned last October over Biden's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. And I asked him to comment on Netanyahu's speech.
I mean, I just think it was such a moment of shame for America in the context of everything that has happened in the last year to see so many of our elected representatives stand up and cheer for a man who is responsible for the deaths of over 15,000 children, of tens of thousands of civilians, for the ongoing starvation of Gaza. It's just a black mark that will stay with us for many, many years to come.
Josh, given that you spent many years in the State Department, would this be possible without the support of Joe Biden and his administration?
No, of course it wouldn't. The U.S. under President Biden has flowed arms and expedited arms, and of course the funding for those arms to Prime Minister Netanyahu throughout the last 9 months, throughout these events in Gaza and these horrible attacks on civilians in Gaza. Not only that, but the U.S. has provided him with the diplomatic top cover to continue blocking ceasefire resolutions at the United Nations, working to prevent accountability through the International Criminal Court, opposing the case that South Africa has brought about genocide before the International Court of Justice, arguing for that matter in domestic U.S. courts against plaintiffs who have been seeking injunctions on arms transfers. So no, this would not have been possible without the United States.
Former State Department official Josh Paul says weapons and bullets are still being sent to Israel on a daily basis. I asked him if Vice President Harris could stop arming Israel if she chooses to do so, if she does win in November.
So, yes, the president ultimately is responsible for these decisions and has the authority to make these decisions. As President Biden, for example, suspended or delayed one shipment of arms during the course of this conflict, for 2,000 pound bombs. The response we saw to that from Congress was to introduce legislation, and that legislation continues to move forward that would force the president to expedite arms and make it illegal for him to slow, pause, or even question any potential arms sales. So I think that even if a President Harris was to, suspend arms transfers to Israel or lethal arms transfers to Israel, there would still be a very difficult fight in Congress to be had over that, that could yet force a President Harris's hand. And, I think we have still a supermajority in Congress who would be willing to move that legislation or that type of legislation forward. And then, of course, there is the impact that such a decision would have on the party and on the politics, of the next congressional election cycle and, frankly, on the funding of the next congressional election cycle. And I think so that would all make it, I think, much more difficult than a simple stroke of the pen, frankly.
That was Josh Paul, former State Department official in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, who resigned last October over President Biden's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Today, we are speaking with Tariq Habash. In January, he publicly resigned from his job as a senior official at the U.S. Department of Education over Biden's support for the assault. Tariq is a Palestinian American. In 1948, his grandparents, aunts, and uncles were forcibly displaced from their homes in Jaffa. Again, Tariq, this is the main question, is if Vice President Harris becomes President Harris, will she continue these policies? Will she continue the $3 billion in funding every year? And will she continue sending bombs and bullets? Because as Josh Paul said, they're being sent on a daily basis. We're just not hearing it as much as we did before because of what's going on with the election right now.
Yeah, I mean, Josh is absolutely right. And unfortunately, it is complicated because a lot of a lot of those different policies, you know, do require action from Congress. I think one thing I will note is that while the president does have the authority to make certain determinations, I think to Josh's point, there are efforts in Congress to limit what the president can and can't do. I think what Congress is trying to do is to force political intervention. What we are seeing from the current president is that there has been repeated political intervention to allow the continuation of weapons and offensive weapons in particular to flow despite violations of U.S. law related to weapons transfer vetting, related to the blocking of humanitarian aid to reach Gaza. I think what the law stipulates is that there has to be a real evaluation of the circumstances, and what Congress would be trying to do is to require political interference so that the law is not actually applied in the way that it was originally intended when they were written, in some cases, over 50 years ago.
There are a lot of reports out today about Netanyahu's speech. It was cheered in Congress mostly by Republicans and decried by hostage families back home. NBC News spoke with Eli Albag, who said, quote, "When he talked for 55 minutes and did not talk about the deal for one second, I was very upset, embarrassed, and angry." He is one of several family members of hostages held by Hamas who demanded to meet with ceasefire negotiators after Israeli media and Reuters reported that an Israeli delegation had not set off for talks in Qatar on Thursday as planned. Instead, it was reported that they were held back until next week. So this is just devastating for these families, Tariq. So many of these families are just so angry about this. I mean, I've been hearing even from some top Israeli officials who are slamming Netanyahu for not talking about a ceasefire to release the rest of the hostages.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's heartbreaking, because I think at the end of the day, it is emblematic that the current policy continues to fail and we are not prioritizing innocent lives that need to be returned. You know, I think there are so many people, Palestinian, Israeli, that really deserve the opportunity to be with their families in peace. And the reality is that the military solution has failed. It has utterly failed. And we need a diplomatic one that actually prioritizes those innocent lives, to return Israeli hostages, to return Palestinian hostages that are being held in administrative detention.
You know, going back to what has been happening in Gaza, I mean, to think that over 39,000 Palestinians have been killed, including 14,000 children, UNICEF says the death toll is likely much higher. More than 80% of the population has been displaced. So we're talking about 80% of 2.2 million people have been displaced. The majority of Gaza's buildings have been destroyed. I mean, the doctors who've been there say you cannot even comprehend the carnage. We just heard from Dr. Sidwa in the first half of the show. And they say that what's to come is so hard to comprehend. What are your thoughts on this, Tariq? What do you think people should be thinking about right now, knowing about right now, given that the election is now getting 24/7 coverage?
I mean, I think that you can't separate what is happening in Gaza from the election. The reality is that the administration right now is set on a failed policy and has been unwilling to change or waver from that policy for over 9 months. And it has cost tens of thousands of lives. It has created unlivable circumstances for over 2 million Palestinians, the vast majority of whom are living in starving circumstances. They have nowhere to live. They don't have access to water. They don't have access to medical supplies. They are literally waiting to be murdered. And so when we think about our policies, when we think about our election, we have to recognize that whoever is running based on what is happening here at home and what is happening in the world and how we are impacting that. And the reality is, when it comes to this policy, when it comes to this genocide, we have to do better, and we need our elected officials to do better, and they have to earn our votes. So what I can say for all of my colleagues, other Americans around the country, is that we have to continue to collectively use our voice. We have to communicate with our elected officials, and we have to make it clear that the dangers that are happening abroad right now are also impacting happening here at home. We're spending billions of dollars on these weapons, and we see countless people here at home suffering economically, suffering from being unhoused, suffering from being unable to afford their educations, suffering from medical debt. There are so many ways that Americans are also suffering, and yet we are so willing to spend so much money on another country's war and justifying the horrific violations of international humanitarian law, and that needs to stop.
Tariq, in our final minute, you decided to publicly resign from your job as a senior official at the U.S. Department of Education back in January. In our final minute, can you talk about, you know, what this experience has been like for you, and what else are you hearing from people who are still working in the Biden administration who oppose his policies but might not be able to resign for various reasons? And we have about a minute left.
Yeah, it's been so many different emotions. Obviously, it was so hard. At the same time, one of the easiest things that I've ever done. Because it was my dream job, I loved the work that I was doing every day, trying to fix a broken student loan system and address racial equity issues and access in education. It was something I cared very deeply about, but I also could not continue to represent an administration that did not recognize my own humanity and continued its daily dehumanization of Palestinian lives that led to violence, both what's happening in Gaza, but also here at home toward Palestinians and Arabs. And just what I've heard from others in the administration, they've been extremely supportive and they want to continue to find ways to help. They want to continue to push on the inside, but they are overwhelmingly supportive. And I'm just so appreciative for the work that they continue to do and the pressure that they continue to push.
Tariq Habash publicly resigned from his job as a senior official at the U.S. Department of Education in January over President Biden's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Tariq is a Palestinian American. In 1948, his grandparents, aunts, and uncles were forcibly displaced from their homes in Jaffa. Tariq, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for helping with today's show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.